Hey, everyone. Welcome to Insights with Ben Siegel. The name of the podcast is based on the ideal notion that each episode will have one insight or one nugget of knowledge to take away after listening to each of our spectacular guests. I'm Ben Siegel, Managing Director of Private Wealth at UBS Financial Services. Our team, Connor Siegel Partners, is based in New York City. After the podcast, I can be reached at benjamin.siegel@ubs.com. Today, our special guest is Barrett White, the former Executive Deputy Chairman and Head of Postwar and Contemporary Art in the Americas at Christie's Auction House. That's a handful. So big welcome, Barrett. Art, auctions, glamour. It's very exciting to be at an auction. But what is the state of the art auction market today?
Ben, first off, thank you for having me and great to be here. The state of the market today is actually one of the most interesting markets I think I've ever seen. And I'd be curious how it correlates to what you're seeing in the broader financial markets, in that we are by no means, on the one hand, at the height of the market. And I think we can most recently track that to 2022 and Christie's sensational sale of the Paul Allen estate, which sort of took the market to a whole nother level.
That was a fantastic collection.
Beyond, right? I mean, it was, as it was titled, visionary. But not only did that collection, you know, set a high watermark that will hold for a very long time, but the overall momentum of the market at that moment was truly extraordinary. 3 years on, we're in a very different place financially in the greater world. But one of the things that I'm most fascinated by is that, unlike some of the previous downturns, I want to underscore that we're not presently in a downturn, but in a dynamic and interesting market. But unlike past times where the market has overall gone down, we're seeing right now a real bifurcation of the market, where the masterpiece market, and I also want to define my terms here, I do not mean simply something that is very expensive. I mean an object that is best in class, whether that be $100,000 or $100 million. The masterpiece market, those things that come to market that have extraordinary provenance, that have been tucked away for decades, have not seen the light of day, have been the coveted objects in museum exhibitions when they have been seen by the public. When those come to market, you're seeing one of the most explosive, exciting, and world record setting markets that we've ever seen, akin to 2022 or other market heights. That said, the parallel market to that is the more pedestrian part of the market, sort of the things that are trading, the things that are good but not truly great. There, I think you can say there's been a not insignificant downturn in that segment of the market, and let's call that somewhere between 20 and 30%. Now, that in to itself, though, presents a real opportunity. So you have a market where there is still a robust amount of participation. You have a market which people want to come into. Art continues to be one of the great luxury objects, and you are, as a great collector, you know, it's another sort of badge of your cultural status. And when you have this sort of somewhat contradictory dynamic, there are actually great buying opportunities within the market. And I think, not to financialize art, and I think I'm going to say now, and I will say throughout this conversation, art should only be bought first and foremost for love. But let's also never forget the fact that this is an extremely expensive asset at this point.
Right. You know? That's really important, to buy something for love.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And I say that in that when you are buying art, this is something that you're going to be living with. It's something that has to, or should, enhance your life. You should not be buying art because it's the same artist that your other friends have. You should not be buying art because you've heard it's a great investment. You should not be buying art because you've been looking at some index that shows this particular artist is going up. None of those are good reasons to buy art. The best reason to buy art, and frankly, the collections over the long term that have had the greatest return, are those collections where the collectors have had an immediate emotional relationship with that artwork. And why do we love and covet art? Why have, you know, people been making art since they lived literally in caves? Because this is a way that we better understand ourselves, right? We are exploring our own psyche, our own humanity, our own personality by making and engaging with art. And so let's take that as a starting premise. And so if you don't have a relationship with a picture that you are going to own, why would you own it, right? So that's the love part. That said, And as I said before, this is a very expensive asset class. And so you cannot be reckless. You cannot say, I love this so much, I will pay whatever it is. You know, there are more and more ways to understand, you know, value. But also always remember that this is a entirely unique asset. This is not gold. It is not a stock. It is not a bond. It is not something where you can benchmark it to other things. Even the body of work of a given artist may very well have wildly different price points. And in the case, I mean, Warhol is always a great example of this. Here's an artist who worked serially, right? He did, whether it was tens or hundreds of the same subject, and he was doing them in a quasi-mechanical way, using a silk screen for the vast majority of his career, not his entire career. Ostensibly, those should be relatively similar objects. But no, it comes down to how, in its simplest form, how good is a particular screen? What screen? What were the chosen colors that he lay underneath? How much pop, oomph, how much wall power does that given work have? And so if you look at something like his Jackies, Jackie Kennedy, one of the great, you know, icons of America. Obviously, Warhol was one of the great pop artists, celebrity, one of his great, you know, subjects. There can be literally 100%+ swing on the value of a picture that is the same scale from the same date and of the same subject, depending on how good that particular rendering of that subject is, the particular pull of the screen and all of the other decisions that Warhol was making to make that painting. And so who's making those determinations?
That's the question I have. Who is doing that? Because that is the magical question.
Right. Well, and I think it really comes down to looking. And if we go back to what I was referring to is that, wow, when you walk into a room and a picture punches you in the gut and you just stop. Right. And you say, I love that. That's what is sort of determining value. And there's an aggregation of how many people decide that this is the picture that is the all-consuming, the all-defining, the picture that they truly love. Now, there's enormous amount of other things at play. Scarcity. And one of the great phenomenons of the art market is pictures that can be dismissed at one point as maybe earlier periods by an artist or more popular subjects by an artist become less available, all of a sudden those things that we were saying, they're not so great, all of a sudden they start looking really good because you can actually get them, right? You know, and so there's all sorts of dynamics, you know, and a great quote I heard once, you know, it was a younger and an older collector, and the younger collector pointed, and it'd be very vague here, you know, but pointed at a painting that the older collector didn't think much of, and he said, hey, you know, what do you think of that? And he said, you know, the older collector said, you know, today, I think it's terrible, but I'm sure in 20 years, I'll think it's a masterpiece.
That's very appropriate, especially for artists who are no longer with us. Mm. For example, I just purchased some Herman Cherys. Mm. He was around with de Kooning.
Sure.
And he's not very well known. I looked at his art and I bought it. I thought it was very interesting. But what happens to artists in the past who get recognized in the future? Because a lot of younger collectors, they look for emerging artists and hoping one day that they like it and it could appreciate. So beside the love of a piece, which I think is very important because it might not appreciate like you do, what aspects should you look for art if you're going to start a collection as a first time or you already have a collection but you want to go to the next level?
Right. I think that there are a host of considerations and a lot of it not dissimilar from financial investing or being an entrepreneur is what is your level of risk tolerance? So you can come into the market and take a position that you want to have a sort of classic, and my field is the 20th century, particularly post-war art, which we define as sort of the after World War II forward. So abstract expressionism, pop, minimalism, so on and so forth. You know, you can come into the market regardless of your price point and decide, all right, I want to buy the great names of this moment in time, whether that's my field, whether that's the first half of the 20th century, which is going to be defined by sort of the School of Paris and modernism, impressionism, etc. Well, the bookend of impressionism, should I say, because that's the end of the 19th century. But whatever field you're attracted to, you can take the more conservative position, you know, which is one where I'm going to buy quality. I'm going to buy what has the imprimatur of time and taste and institutions. And these are the artists who are in the art history books, right? They're not going anywhere.
Right.
Now, you're also, with that approach, if we're talking about this from a financial perspective, you know, the high probability is that there's going to be a slower burn for those, but there'll be a steady but slow growth of value in those artists, assuming that you're buying good examples, right? And again, that can be drawings, which are much more affordable, you know, paintings on paper, to major canvases, which can be extremely expensive if we're talking about Warhol or de Kooning or what have you. Alternately, you might look at someone like Herman Cherry. First off, congratulations. I think Herman Cherry is a fabulous artist. And there's always been huge opportunities, but I think people have become much more focused on, in the last 10 or 15 years, this idea of excavating art history. And it also kind of goes to the point that I was making before, when it's like, when there's Picassos and de Koonings everywhere, it's pretty easy to focus on them.
Right.
Once those become either so expensive or so rare, you know, then you start looking around and thinking, what else is there out there? And I think it also segues correctly with the last few decades, where there's been a recognition that to date, our canon was somewhat limited, right? That there were a lot of overlooked people.
What makes someone who's overlooked become, for the art community to get more excited? Is it something in marketing? Is it the quality of the art, or is it just the changing of time and people's tastes change?
These are hard questions to answer. That there's some, if we all had the formula,
right?
You know, we would be excavating Herman Cherry every week, and minting money, right? You know? But no, I like to think, and the vast majority of times starts with the quality of the work, where these were artists who were in dialogue with their moment. They were contributing to the evolution of whether it was a particular zeitgeist or a very specific style, and they were meaningful participants, you know, in their moment. And then the question is, why were they lost to history? And there are often, it is self-choice. So, I mean, just there's a great artist by the name of Lee Bonacieux, for example. And Bonacieux showed a Castelli, was, you know, major sort of figure in her moment. And to simplify the story, overall found sort of the art world and the scene not to her liking, and moved away, stopped showing for a while, right? Or at least stopped showing in major hubs, and, you know, lived the life that she wanted to live. And then decades later, people were sort of like, huh, what is this great work? You know, and why aren't we seeing more of it? Now, I don't know what the thing is that brings everyone to the same consensus, but the art world does have a kind of magical way of, more often than not, agreeing as these artists are sort of excavated, agreeing that yes, they are really damn good, right? You know, and this market should be a lot further ahead than it is. And you start seeing, think about it, if you can buy something for $100,000 or $200,000 that is arguably amongst the best examples of the artist's work, and you peg that artist to one of their peers where the same best example is many tens of millions of dollars, that only makes sense. But it also creates a bit of a frenzy. So, I mean, another artist was, but her market is Ruth Asawa. And again, Ruth Asawa sort of, she was out on the West Coast. She had been, she's sort of fascinating story. She's Japanese American. She'd been in one of the internment camps. She started making these incredible sculptures that were a combination of Mexican weaving techniques, and she was weaving out of metal and creating these sort of incredible biomorphic surrealist objects. But her career was relatively quiet and on the West Coast. But however many years or however many decades later, everyone sort of came to the same conclusion at the same time. This is a major, major artist who we've overlooked, has had this sort of regional reputation, but deserves a much bigger one. And you literally saw, so her major works were these sort of hanging pendants. You know, you literally saw these in the course of 3 years go from $100,000 to $2 million or $3 million. She's now represented by David Zwirner. Christie's actually did one of the first major exhibitions in New York in advance of Zwirner. There's major museum shows, one opening in San Francisco right now, or has just opened, and excuse my not knowing exactly, but forthcoming. And again, it starts with the quality. And then it goes from there. And now that's not to say that every good artist, because there are more artists in the world, many of whom probably deserve to, or is as good as some of the other, you know,
right.
great so, artists. Yeah. And it's a matter of luck in some capacity, yes. right? You know, who are the tastemakers? Who are the curators that see your work? Who are the collectors that become obsessed with you? Who are like...
It's a fine line. It's just like yeah. athletes. The people who don't make pros, there's plenty of people who have that same quality. What attributes do you think great artists have or great art has? Like the artists, what do you think they have in common?
And I think there's two fundamental things. You know, and one of the criteria, and I've been looking at art literally my entire life. You know, I've told you before, my mother was a painter. I grew up when I was in my single digits going to the Yale Art School after school and hanging out and looking at these crazy people's, you know, artwork, and then coming into New York when I was...
Doesn't sound like my high school experience.
Fair, right? Coming in at, you know, age 8, 9, and 10 to Soho in the 80s, when Soho was still a actual artist's place and sort of gritty and dangerous, and thinking, what the hell are these people doing?
Right. You know,
I say all of this in that I've always been around art in my life, and I've always been open to the idea of highly conceptual art. I think that art needs to have a strong intellectual underpinning. But I will also say, having spent my entire life around art, that it cannot solely stand on an intellectual premise. And so this is getting back to sort of what makes what a great artist share. There is a profound and innate sense of aesthetic, your craft, whatever medium you're working in. How are you able to make something that makes you stop and say, wow, right? I'm constantly right. get back to where I started,
yeah.
right? You know, and I'm not quite, yes, it is about learning how to paint. You know, it is about learning how to sculpt. It is about learning how to make great photographs. You know, one of the, you know, I actually started in Christie's photographs department. And one of the amazing things is seeing the difference between digital photography today, which is very sort of vanilla, right?
It's,
I mean, it can be manipulated. I'm not to say that there aren't great photographers working today, but there's not the craft of printing any longer. And if you go back and you have these sort of incredible printing processes that no longer exist, and the objecthood of them was incredible, in the same way that the objecthood of a sculpture or painting can be truly incredible. And so these are artists who have honed their craft entirely. And to use a giant cliche, right? And whether it was Charlie Parker, whether it was John Coltrane, I don't recall, but may not have been either of them. But it's like someone says, hey, like, how do you become a great, you know, jazz musician? How do you improvise like that? And they say, look, kid, you've got to learn everything and then forget it, right? But you have to learn everything first and foremost, right? And so a great artist, 9 times out of 10, you know, is somebody who has studied the craft, who has learned their craft, who has become a great artist. But then it's something beyond. How is it that somebody can convey, again, that sense of grandeur, humanity, pathos, you know, whatever it is that they are putting forth that resonates with people on a universal or near universal level, right? Like we all, sure, there's some people who say Picasso's not a great artist, but they're pretty few and far between, right? Yeah. We all look at his pictures and are like, wow, that's great. And so that's what that is. I don't think any of us really know what that is at the end of the day.
You know, it reminds me of a book I read in college, Zen, the Art of Archery, and it's about doing the same thing over and over. At some point, it becomes effortless.
Right.
And
right.
then you're able to transmit how you feel, and people can absorb that. And so it seems like you've had immense success in your career. Mm. And from listening to you, it seems like being passionate about something, really understanding, and where it becomes effortless, so you enjoy your everyday work.
Yeah. You know, I've been in this industry since I was 24 years old. I'm 50 years old now. You know, so I consider myself enormously lucky to have spent every day, whether it was cataloging and researching objects, interacting with great collectors and collections, being privy to and part of some of the great auctions. That's great. It's been an incredible, incredible job.
So when you reflect back, what do you think that you've learned over that your career in the auction world and art that you wish you might have known from the beginning?
I think probably the most important thing, if you really want to learn about art in the broadest sense,
right,
is to not be afraid or ashamed or embarrassed to admit you don't know something. The art world has gotten so vast, truly global. There are more galleries in New York City alone than you could possibly see in a weekend, let alone a week, let alone a month. And then multiply that by all of the great art capitals around the world, which, by the way, are in every continent in the world. This is not just in America and France.
Right.
And it is truly, truly global. So that's the joy of it. And so it is taking the time to listen to people, taking the time to ask questions, taking the time to say, you know what, I don't know that, but I'd love to learn, right? And
right,
tell me about that. And I think one of the things that was greatest for me, particularly when I was young, but continuing today, is the collectors who I've had the privilege to work with and have enjoyed working with the most of those people that I've had an ongoing dialogue with. And they're more often than not teaching me more than I've been able to teach them. And that's okay. You know, and they tend to be a bit older than I am.
Right.
You know, they were sort of there when. And it's not to say I don't provide an enormous amount of information and knowledge for them as well. But hearing the stories, or they've just gone around the world and they've spent 4 weeks in Southeast Asia, or they've been in, you know, the UAE, or they've been somewhere spectacular and they've seen a whole new art scene that I haven't had the pleasure of seeing yet, and hearing about that. So maybe it's something that was in the past, or maybe it's something that's just going on today. But no one wants to look like they don't know something. But I think if you just admit to yourself from the get-go that it is unknowable,
right,
in its entirety, and be open to listening, you know, that's where you're going to, you can actually become the greatest connoisseur by saying, I don't know.
So then if you have an emotional reaction to a piece of art, then understand that you're limited in your knowledge. And the best way to purchase art is to get more educated, be more open-minded. And then when you don't understand something, try to learn about it. Mm-hmm. I get that. So let's go back to the basics. A lot of people who start an art collection, they either start buying it from galleries or they go to an art auction. So if I'm a first-time buyer going to an art auction, I'm a newbie, and everyone thinks they understand how to buy art at an auction. Can you give us some guidelines of what we should be considering when we go to that auction so we don't get caught up in the moment, that we don't buy something that we should not be buying,
right,
and we have a better experience?
Right. I mean, again, we talked a little bit earlier about sort of what is your risk, right, threshold, you know, but it's also what are you responding to? But I think the thing that if you don't want to sort of get burned in the market, and I will say this is an extremely complex market with a finite group of collectors, which means the participation of one, two, or three more people versus one, two, or three less people can have radical impacts on what the outcome of a price for a given artwork is, right? And so there are any number of things that are essentially out of your control, but probably the most dangerous thing you can do is buy with trends, follow what is fashionable. And once you have identified the type of art that you like, once you have identified the artists that resonate with you, then it's about asking questions. And whether it's at galleries or whether it's at auction houses or whether you've engaged an art advisor, the art professional community, we're all very interested in the things that we're selling. We're extremely passionate about those artists. We are extremely passionate about certain moments in time. And if you create a relationship or multiple relationships with people that you trust, that you know, or have a long-term interest in a relationship with you, who aren't just looking to sort of sell you one picture and make a killing and move on, because frankly, right, that's a terrible strategy.
I'm sure it doesn't happen much.
I know. But if you identify those people you really feel comfortable with, ask them about why is this a great picture versus that. And that can go from the very fundamental things, just the condition of a picture. Is it in good or bad condition, right? You know, but it can also be about what are the different periods, if you're looking at historic art, what are the different periods of an artist, and why are certain periods more or less valued by the market? But then think about what your eye is saying. And if you happen to really like something that is less in favor than what the market likes, if you're collecting long-term, maybe that's a really smart thing. But it's ultimately, it comes down to getting as much information, So we have the very simple condition. We have the understanding where a given work sits in this sort of historical arc of an artist's larger body of work. But then also understanding the specific history of that work, which can often tell you a number of things. And this is by no means a hard and fast rule. But often, many of the most sort of cherished and desirable things have been in one or two or three collections for many, many years. It's those things that have been sort of bouncing around. If you've seen something that's come to market 4 and 5 and 6 times in 10 years, not to say that you shouldn't buy it, but it's a heck of a question to ask. And if you have that group of trusted advisors that you can call on and sort of say, like, guys, like, what is your experience with this particular object? Why might it have come to auction 2 or 3 times, been in a handful? There may be a totally plausible reason for that. It may also be that it's never quite found a home. It may not be the great example. Now, your eye is going to be the great arbiter of that, because if you're collecting seriously, even something that is bounced around any number of times, if you take it out of circulation for 20 or 30 years, you can change that dynamic on your own, right? You know, so again, there's not one thing that is some giant red flag or a giant green flag. I mean, you don't just go or stop based on, but it's getting the holistic picture of a given object, understanding where it sits within an artist's body of work, understanding whether or not it has been well treated throughout its life,
right.
Then understanding, all right, how was that artist as a practitioner? There are certain artists where you have a huge amount of leeway on condition. Joan Mitchell, one of the great, abstract expressionists. The pictures are, there's so much paint, there's so much force behind them, etc. She was creating them, at a speed and using certain pigments that, putting all those things together, they tend to have a lot of cracking. There tend to be losses on them. This is widely accepted and okay for Joan Mitchell. That is not okay for Agnes Martin, who is doing these ethereal, sort of sheaths of color, these minimalist meditations. If you have cracking all over that, that's highly problematic, right? Yeah. And so you have to also understand, what's the artist practice, into itself. And so these are all the sort of nuances. And as you're talking to the people you trust in the art world, you're going to start understanding what are the things that you want to be looking for? What are the things you want to be thinking about when you're considering buying this particular object by this particular artist? And again, those things can shift, right?
So there is some method of madness to buying art.
Absolutely.
So with regard to art, does it, as opposed to the stock market, being a contrarian can work a lot of times.
Particularly if you're long-term.
Right. And so being a contrarian in the art market, for example, I think old masters are out of favor. How does one think about that? And when you are a contrarian, what should you be looking for if you're buying because you, A, love the painting, and you think down the road it might appreciate?
I think one thing that we always have to recognize is that...
Is it the quality of work?
Well, no, yeah. Certainly the quality of work, right? But that also taste comes in cycles, right? And so what is the basis of the auction house's business, if you go back 50, 100 years, was what we now refer to as brown furniture, antique furniture, beautiful dining room tables and beautifully hand-carved chairs and, highboys. And that is, other than the museum quality works, that collecting segment is completely out of favor right now. Mid-century design is the dominant form of furniture. I mean, for lack of a better word, design sort of transcends furniture, but, for lack of a better word. But that's not to say that if you're buying incredible antique furniture, that won't cycle back around, And so it always comes, you said it, it always comes, no matter what you're buying, buy the best that you can possibly buy. One of the things that always makes me
So worried. By quality.
Correct. I get worried when people are sort of like, well, it's not great, but I can probably buy it well. It's like, right, but you can buy it well because it's not great. Let's turn that, you know, right. You know. And so it's like, and again, this is not about spending hundreds of millions of dollars, but whatever it is, whatever type of object you're buying, buy the best one that you can possibly buy, you know, and make sure that it's something that has that sort of sizzle, that unnameable greatness to it.
Going through a different path, if someone inherits an art collection because of death, or there's a divorce, or there's debt, how does one approach an auction house who has a lot of experience on acquiring assets and selling them versus this is your first time trying to sell your art? You could have hundreds of millions of dollars, or you could have $1 million worth of art. You might never have sold anything. What are the considerations that you need to really think about so you have at least a good position and not get taken advantage of?
Let's assume that we're talking about a collection of significance.
Yes.
Right. The reality of the art market, or at least let me rephrase that, the reality of the auction business is that there are two major houses, Christie's and Sotheby's, and Phillips is the third major house, but obviously is by design a smaller shop than the two sort of behemoths. If you have something that you know is highly desirable in the marketplace, and you can do that with a quick Google, frankly, and also you can do that by having a couple of conversation with auction house specialists, and you'll see them react. You know, if you have things that they want to sell, you know, they are going to be extremely, extremely accommodating. So as far as making sure that you're getting the best possible financial deal, there are a number of different types of financial arrangements that can be made.
Yeah. So for example, what are, not to go how to reduce them, but what are the things that when you go to auction house that you should be thinking of? What are the items?
Right. And so what you want to understand is how are they going to market my collection? Which house do I believe has the best expertise in a given segment of the market? Or a given area. And I think this is a very important point because, you know, people sort of say, well, Christie's and Sotheby's is sort of the same company. And on the face of it, that is true. But they both have stronger and weaker departments within that greater organization, right? You know, who has the most experience, you know, that will often correlate to who has the most experience selling these given artists that are in this collection, who's going to be able to access the most likely buyers for this in the most effective way. Not to say, again, the vast majority of major collectors speak to both houses, right?
Right.
You know, but who has the best relationship? Those are
and that's nurtured over many years.
Yeah, and one of the things I always said to people when I was at Christie's, and I believe this fundamentally, is in a business where one bid can be tens, hundreds, or millions of dollars, one bid, who can get you the edge to get one more bid? Right? Because it can have a giant impact. And that's where when you start thinking about, all right, you know, who has the most experience with this given artist and most likely may be able to explain things or has been engaging with clients in a way that might get me that extra bid. That's an incredibly important consideration. You know, I think from a financial point of view, assuming that you're both talking to both houses, they're going to give you a competitive deal. Right, they know it is an extremely competitive duopoly functionally, and they're not going to try and pull the wool over your eyes, right? And I'd be less worried about that, assuming that you're having two conversations, if not three conversations, to understand what your financial options are. But at the end of the day, it's not always necessarily getting the best possible deal. It's believing that you have the best possible partner. You know, and I think that can be influenced by
It's
a big nuance, right? But I think it's something, and you can take a variety of approaches. You can do the research on your own. You can understand who has been selling things that are most like yours the best, right? And you can figure that out. You can also potentially hire an art advisor. You know, that costs money, and there is a finite amount of profit. You know, these people think this is this extremely glamorous, amazing, you know, business. It is a business of very small margins, you know, with enormous overhead. And there is only so much money to go around at the end of the day. And
right.
So, you know, by engaging an advisor, that takes, you know, another piece out of the pie. But for some people, that's money extremely well spent because it's someone who can navigate for them this extremely complex world. Other people like to, you know, it's the feel of, does the team respond to me? Do I believe that these are the people who are going to be the best stewards? It's not that complex. And you're basically, there are in a marquee season in New York at either house, you know, an evening sale will have 50 to 80 lots. A day sale will have 150 to 300 lots. You can understand the context. I think this is probably one of the most important questions. And one of the things that you should always be thinking about is, what does the competitive landscape look like? And how can I best navigate that? Because people often say, well, if I give you this, you can't have another one. It's like, well, right. But if I don't take it, it's going to go up the street. So it's still going to be in the market. So right. let's have a collaboration around how can we best manage what the landscape, you know, of a given season looks like. And so I think it's really thinking about and really choosing who you think is going to be your best collaborator to help you navigate this very sort of somewhat bizarre landscape that is sort of the major auction markets, and whether you find that with the auction house specialists. And I will say, they genuinely want to work with you. They genuinely want to give you their best advice. They genuinely want to see you succeed. Now, everyone is in business. Everyone has an agenda.
Right.
But literally everyone is in business and everyone has an agenda. So it's the auction houses are no different from anyone else in that regard, but they can be outstanding advisors. You may choose to have someone who is dealing with a lot of these sort of strategic decisions, who has experience in that, and that would be a different choice, you know. But so it's really sort of going in, and I don't mean to sound like a broken record, but it's going in, it's asking questions, saying, walk me through this from the beginning. How would you envisage this happening? And I assume you're like me, you know, I meet people all the time who are offering services. I need a new this or that or whatever it may be. You're reading people.
So one of the attributes is trust.
100%. Because you're dealing with a highly subjective market, one that can't be that controlled. So you really want to be working with the people that you trust. And that could be an auction house, that can be a gallery, that can be an advisor, can be a private dealer. Because you're also, like, if you have a collection, you're also not limited to selling at auction. It's often the correct way to go. There is a value to sort of a collection presentation. There is a expediency to a sale happening on a given day. And I will also say auctions are remarkable in their effectiveness for activating people. You know, people who are sitting on their hands, can't make a decision, have been offered something. I mean, just to sort of go off subject for a second, you know, the number of times that I've offered somebody something, I'm going to make up numbers here, but offer them a great object for $2 million. And they say, you're crazy, you know, maybe for $1 million, et cetera. 6 months later, shows up at auction, you know, they pay for it, $5 million. And you're like, there's this sort of incredible, like when I say activation, right, that the auction room provides a arena of competition. It's fast moving, it's theater, it's exciting, you know, you get swept away by it, right?
And it's incredible how they make it so exciting. I don't know anyone who doesn't like watching an auction.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, this is one of the things that was amazing during COVID, when both houses moved their auctions, not online entirely, though there was a major shift to online sales, but even their marquee sales started being televised. You couldn't have people in the rooms immediately. You know, ensuing years, you could have fewer people than you'd had in the past, etc. There were millions and millions and millions of people tuning in to watch art auctions. It was a revelation in many regards, and people loved it. I mean, it is a fascinating insight into this sort of, you know, extraordinary and until recently relatively closed world. So yeah, no, it's highly entertaining. And it's highly entertaining to participate in, and it's highly entertaining to watch, and it's highly entertaining to see all the different machinations and mechanics of what's going on, and how these sort of these major sales are brought about and executed, because they're really being executed by the houses, and they do a remarkable job of orchestrating and maximizing value when they can, you know, for collectors. And it's, I mean, it is a thing to behold, and I will say, you know, a thing I will miss. thankfully.
If we were sitting here 20 years from now, how do you envision the art market looking then? Given that you have digital art, you have younger generations, do they have the same kind of passion for art? Do you envision it being different or the same? I mean, the art market's been relatively long-lasting. Out of asset classes, it's been around a long time, and there's always a demand because people like seeing beautiful things and having them. But do you think there's going to be a big change down the road?
Look, yes. And let's just go back, you know, to the most obvious example. You know, if you were to ask that question at the turn of the 19th century, would they think 100 years later that they would be staring at a urinal, you know, that had scrawled on it "R. Mutt," and that 50 years after that, people would be clamoring to put that into a museum? They would tell you you were insane, right? So let's remember that art represents, is born of the society of which it is a part, and it is reflecting back that society, right? And so I am not a technology person. I'm not a social media person. These are not things that I've particularly engaged with. Do I believe that digital art has a place in the pantheon? 100%. When Beeple came to Christie's to sell what became this incredible NFT, you know, and started off this giant craze, which, by the way, has subsided. And everyone says, oh, well, it was a flash in the pan. No, it was the first foray into something that is going to become more sophisticated, that's going to become more interesting, that's going to become more and more entwined in our society. Technology is the single biggest driver of our society right now, period. How can we not have art that not only reflects that, but incorporates that, right? And so it's going to become more and more sophisticated. And so in 20 years, if talk about like what was so incredible about the 20th century was the rapidity of modernity, how things were evolving. We've now gone into hyperspeed. The rate of which things are evolving makes the 20th century look like the dawn of man. No. And so it would be insane to think that technology, I'm just going to say, use the word technology, and all of the anything digital, anything NFT, anything, you know, won't be a major part of it. Will we recognize it? Will I recognize it? Well, you know, maybe, maybe not. Will I love it? Maybe, maybe not. But what I will say is, as a market observer, as a market participant, I will always respect whether or not I like it. If I think that it has merit, that if I think that it is of its time, if I think that it is reflecting back that society, as I said before, that's the important art, right? And if you think about so much great art has been made in times of enormous upheaval or in moments where the world is rebuilding after enormous upheaval, because people's lives have been turned upside down and they're looking to understand those lives again. And great art gets made, right? And I would say, if nothing else, we are in a moment of extraordinary change. You know, this feels like one of the historical inflection moments of all inflection moments, you know, and I would posit that in the next 20 years, there should and could be some of the best art that will ever be made. We may or may not recognize it immediately.
Wow, that's very insightful. And do you have any recommendations of a book or books that someone should read? There's a lot, so many books on art and on different artists, but is there a general one that is a go-to book? And if there's not, you know, if any way, when you say educate yourself, what should they actually do? What does it actually mean?
My very brief and unprepared bibliography. John Berger's Ways of Seeing is a great sort of treatise on literally looking at art. David Hickey, any of his essays. David Hickey is a punk rock art historian. You know, one of his great books is called Air Guitar, right? And these are essays that, you know, he was writing 30 and 40 years ago, they're conflating basically, you know, modern sociology and culture with fine arts, bringing the high and the low together, which until not that long ago was anathema. And I think Hickey is absolutely brilliant. And again, it's not that he's not a market observer, he's not, but it's just it's getting comfortable with thinking about art, getting comfortable with knowing that there's not just one way to look or think about art, that all of the museum curators and all of the art world professionals, you know what? Your opinion is as valid as mine. Your opinion is as valid as the most esteemed curator or critic in the world. And I think that, you know, those books, those authors sort of lend themselves towards telling you that you can look, right? Beyond that, the other thing that my personal choice, I stopped reading art theory in college. I found it to be laborious. I found it to often be worthless. I found it to be navel-gazing, shall we say. It would be a polite way of putting it, right? And what I started reading exclusively, biography. Biographies of the artists and or biographies of the moment. You know, meaning there are a number of books which speak to abstract expressionism. So there's a new book out called Quintus Slip that's talking about sort of Agnes Martin and Robert Motherwell and Ellsworth Kelly and Jack Youngerman and all, you know, and you get this sort of incredible sense of history, right? And that's why, and I'm going to call all of that biography, whether it is art biography or artist biography, I don't really care. Like that to me is what is like, if you really want to get the taste, the feel, the sense of a place, read about the lives. Don't read what some esoteric theorist thinks of it 30 years in retrospect, or even at the time, like some theory is fine, right? And some of it's important and fine. But generally speaking, like it's really more about what were these people doing? What were the things that led to their finding their voice as an artist? And most of that is going to be their biography. It's not going to be art theory, right? You know, and so that's, I would just say as a genre, read biography because A, it's super interesting. And B, you're gonna start understanding why these different pictures were being made at different times. Right. You know, and I think that's hugely important. Hugely important.
Right. Well, Barrett, thank you so much for your time. We're very lucky to have one of the top art experts in the world speaking with us today and look forward to more conversations. Thank you very much.
No, a great pleasure. I hope I actually gave some coherent answers and I really enjoyed this. So thank you. And I hope to come back.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.